Conversations, a podcast that explores the depths of synthetic biology from various multidisciplinary standpoints. I'm Tess King, your host for today. I'm a third-year student here at the University of Toronto, studying physics and physical geography. Conversations is a five-episode long podcast created by the University of Toronto Policy and Practices Division of its iGEM team, a student club dedicated to synthetic biology. For our first episode, we'll be unfolding the history of synthetic biology and delving into the definition of what synthetic biology really is and its importance. Also joining us today are Victoria, our wet lab lead.
All right. Hi, my name is Victoria Sitovich, and I am the research and development wet lab lead for the iGEM team.
Ali, our dry lab lead.
My name is Ali, and I am currently the R&D lead for the dry lab. I'm currently studying statistics and fundamental genetics and its applications.
And hi, I'm Este, and I'm the policy and practices lead, third year ethics, society and law and bioethics major. And I'm the resident biology novice today, and I'll be asking questions when I don't understand something.
Now some context into synthetic biology and its development. The origins of synthetic biology can be traced back to 1828. When Frederick Wöhler, a German chemist, applied ammonium chloride to silver isocyanate to produce urea, substance that is found in urine. Later on, in 1970s, this field gradually advanced when scientists conducted experiments in genetic engineering and recombinant DNA technology. In other words, scientists modified the genetic code of a naturally occurring bacteria to alter their function. This gave rise to the production of biological drugs such as insulin, a hormone secreted by the pancreas that helps break down sugar in your body. Following the rise of genetic engineering in the early 2000s, researchers found ways to create customized genes which were built from scratch. Using these customized stretches of DNA, scientists have been creating organic compounds that are tailored towards specific needs. For instance, artemisinin, an anti-malarial drug that is produced from the naturally occurring wormwood plant. By using the techniques in synthetic biology, the scientists combined the DNA sequences of the plant with that of yeast and bacteria to increase the production of artemisinin. Now to segue into our interview part. So, Ali, what's your definition of synthetic biology?
My definition for synthetic biology is the engineering of cellular systems and their components. So, genetics and proteins.
So could you explain for the biologically challenged audiences like myself what genetics and proteins and all this stuff is?
Genetics refers to the DNA, and DNA is essentially the instruction manual, and the proteins are the tools that are used to build them. So like, let's say you're getting a bookshelf from IKEA, right? You get the instruction manual, you get your materials, and you have tools. The instruction manual would be the DNA and the tools would be the proteins.
My personal definition of synthetic biology is it is a discipline of science that's all about creation. It really focuses on these like universal design principles, whereby techniques or understanding from the realms of physics, engineering, mathematics all comes together to try to nail down the principles of life. So in contrast to, say, molecular biology, where you're trying to understand the fundamental function of a particular gene and how it works in the system as a whole, in synthetic biology, you're taking your knowledge of the entire realm and then using that to create something that's novel.
What are you guys doing?
Okay, so our project this summer is trying to figure out a mechanism by which we can control the CRISPR-Cas9 system. It's currently of huge interest in medicine because there's a lot of diseases that have a genetic basis, such as cystic fibrosis, that we really want to eliminate. And gene editing is one way by which we could possibly do this in the future. The only problem with the CRISPR-Cas9 system is all the kinks of it have not been completely worked out because we don't have a complete enough understanding of it yet to really implement it in the clinic. And one of the problems with CRISPR is it's difficult to control exactly when this Cas9 endonuclease makes a cut. So what our project is trying to do this summer is to create some way of controlling the CRISPR-Cas9 system and basically turning it on or off at will. So what we've done is actually put the CRISPR system under the control of a protein that responds to light. So you can basically shine light on the system and turn it on. And then in order to turn the CRISPR system off, we have something called an anti-CRISPR protein, which, just like the name implies, it basically binds to this entire assembly of molecular factors and abrogates its activity. So we've essentially devised a genetic switch for turning CRISPR on and off. And we're looking to implement that this summer in the lab.
Oh, what is CRISPR?
Okay, so the CRISPR-Cas9 system actually refers to the innate immune system of bacteria. So what the system is designed to do is identify foreign invaders, bacteriophages, which are essentially viruses that attack bacteria. So what the system actually stands for is clustered regularly interspaced short palindromic repeats. But what that essentially refers to is a region of DNA in which there are these repeated sections that are interspaced by these sequences of DNA that match viruses that have previously infected these bacteria. So what that allows bacteria to do upon a new infection is basically take those sequences, transcribe them into CRISPR RNAs.
What is RNA exactly?
RNA is basically like a ribonucleic acid. It's the intermediate step between DNA and protein. It's kind of referred to as the central dogma of molecular biology. Everything, information flows from DNA to RNA to protein. So it's like an intermediate step. So this intermediate step basically couples to a protein, which is referred to as Cas9, and then it searches along the bacterial genome looking for a similar sequence to that CRISPR RNA. So what scientists have basically figured out how to do is to synthetically alter that CRISPR RNA into a single guide RNA, which just means it's all one molecule, and then it can find any other sequence in the genome, similar to the search function in a word processor. So it's almost as if you can find like any set of letters in the entire genome to find a very specific location.
What would you use that for?
Okay, so as I was explaining previously, scientists have found a way to basically modify the sgRNA, which is like the search function. So scientists can actually go in, locate any gene in the entire genome, and then because the Cas9 is called an endonuclease, which means it basically has the ability to create double-stranded breaks in the DNA, you can go in and cut any sequence of DNA, and then you can insert exogenous sequences.
What does exogenous mean?
It means like any DNA sequence that comes from another source. It's not common to the organism itself. So that's like one of the broader themes in synthetic biology as a whole, because the DNA code is actually universal. Like everybody has A, T, C, and G in their genome.
Everybody.
It just refers to these four different nucleotides that in different sequences create different chemical messages. And then those messages are basically read by a variety of other chemical messengers in your body to like, create, to express whatever these genes are saying, which is in terms of proteins. So basically, like the long and the short of the CRISPR-Cas9 system is we can go find any gene, cut it, and insert new DNA, or we can just cut the gene to disable its function.
Why would we want to do that, though?
For a variety of means. That's getting to why we have synthetic biology in the first place. So now that we better understand these biological principles, we can go in and basically use biological organisms to do any sort of function that we want. So say you have a plant, and you know the global food crisis is a major issue right now, and you want to increase the photosynthetic capacity of a particular plant so it's more productive and you have higher yield. So we can go in and try to alter these metabolic pathways with genes from other organisms to basically create something that will aid human society in some way.
So what is a dry lab generally?
So a dry lab is basically using computational and mathematical models on biological concepts. So when you have your wet lab, you have those people in wet lab coats doing the transformations, collecting the data. That data is then transferred to dry lab, and they basically analyze it, and they develop theoretical models to explain why that data came about.
So are you sitting in a lab with petri dishes and pipettes?
No. We're like usually just sitting at home or like in some like little room with like laptops and just coding pretty much or doing research.
So what type of software are you using or methods in which you are implementing the work in dry lab?
So MathWorks provided iGEM teams with a free package for MATLAB and SimBiology, which we are going to be using to model the system, like I said before. Basically, what it allows us to do is set up the system computationally through matching different proteins, different genes with their enzyme dynamics than creating a theoretical mathematical model that's already been well established in bioinformatics research. Then we're essentially just going to run that, and it will give us an output file, which is going to be the data for how our system works. So it will be the dynamics between CRISPR and anti-CRISPR versus our activation with the light system. And once we understand that, we're going to utilize an optimization tool also presented in MATLAB, which is given to us through MathWorks.
Okay, could you explain what MATLAB is?
Okay, MATLAB is a mathematical software package. It's basically a programming language that is designed fully to handle matrices, calculus, all that kind of stuff that you need to sort of apply mathematics to the real world.
So what do you think is one of the most important discoveries of synthetic biology?
I think actually just one of the most important discoveries is before the field of synthetic biology even was a thing. I believe that it was the discovery of the double helix structure by Rosalind Franklin, because not only was it the basis for everything in biology now, it's also a story that has like a lot of meat to it, and there's just like a lot of drama behind the whole. Like,
wait, Rosalind Franklin, wasn't it Crick and Watson who discovered double helix?
Yeah, they kind of stole it. They were all doing research on it, but Rosalind Franklin is the one who actually used crystallography to determine the structure and figured out how to like actually see DNA. And when she finally shared it with one of them, they kind of just took it and they both got credit for it. That's why it's called the Watson-Crick model, not the Watson-Crick-Rosalind model. They kind of just cut her out of the whole loop. And the sad part about that story was she never got any credit for it, obviously. She got sick from the radiation. And on top of that, she didn't get her Nobel Prize because she died before it was given to her.
Wow, those guys are massive snakes. All right. So where do you see the technological advances of synthetic biology taking us?
I feel like the technological advances of synthetic biology will take us in a similar way that the technological advances with computers took us. Essentially, I believe that it's going to get so complex and advanced that we're eventually going to be able to develop new proteins, new systems, new organisms to fit our very, very basic needs. So, for example, we already have those seedless tomatoes. We have something called golden rice, which is basically rice, but like jam-packed with vitamins and nutrients. It's obviously not natural, right? But it's extremely good for your health. And I think it's going to essentially go one step further. We're already developing crops to withstand harsh environments. We're starting to make featherless chickens, which I find like very funny. That's
happening. A little disturbing,
you know?
But yeah, all right.
They're freaky, but like it's very interesting that they're doing that, right? It's going to be used to make the everyman's day or life a lot easier.
What was your guys' motivation for joining the U of T iGEM team?
So I actually heard about iGEM way back in high school. I watched a documentary on it and I was always like, oh yeah, I want to do this because it seems very interesting. However, when I got to first year, I sat in that club room and I was like, okay, everyone's way too smart for me. I'm just like a first year, so I'm not going to do it. And a couple of years later, when I got more knowledge, I discovered bioinformatics. And I figured, yeah, I really want to do this aspect of it because I love math, statistics, and the application of it in genetics and systems biology is just so fascinating to me. So I applied, I somehow got in, and yeah, that's how I got into iGEM.
I've basically been absolutely obsessed with the CRISPR-Cas9 system, and I really was looking for a club that was focusing on these new and upcoming applications of synthetic biology. I have a little bit of lab experience. I've always wanted to work in a lab my entire life, and I feel like iGEM is the perfect place to acquire the experience of like running a project and hopefully like moving synthetic biology forward, albeit in a very small way.
Yeah, I got into synthetic biology a long time ago when I first watched Jurassic Park and they extracted the DNA from the mosquitoes and reverse engineered the dinosaurs. That's kind of like what I wanted to do growing up. So I was like, okay, I'll study biology. And, you know, eventually, hopefully, when I get, like, my PhD, this is the thing I'll do. I'll create Jurassic Park, and I'll become like a multimillionaire. You know, start my own biotech company, just creating dinosaurs for like the everyday kid.
Personally, I'm going to add that I don't think that would be possible at the current state that synthetic biology is in. However, yeah, dream big. Okay,
like, we put a man on the moon, so I'm pretty sure we can do this too. You know, they thought that was impossible. They told the Wright brothers that was impossible. I'm sure like 10 years from now, we have chickens, like giant featherless buff chickens. We're going to like start making dinosaurs and things like that. You never know.
Fair point, but the practicality of that. Don't you think there's more important problems in medicine and with respect to the environment right now?
Yeah. You know, that like it makes sense, but you can't just pour like we're already pouring billions of dollars into these problems and they're not getting solved any faster. There's like so much money in the world. You got NBA players making hundreds of millions of dollars, right? Like, that's not a big problem. Somebody can't watch basketball, but like we do it anyway, right? There's some things that are more important than just solving world problems. It's, you know, it's about advancing humanities in some other ways.
I fundamentally disagree with that.
What the?
I definitely agree with you that it is essential for humanity to have some things that are just fascinating and fun, and that's part of human creativity. But I think that's why synthetic biology has such a great allure, because you're using that creativity in a way that is actually going to push us forward and to solve those world problems. Because if you solely focus on regenerating the dinosaurs, then it becomes a sort of farcical discipline and a sort of attempt for dreamers, whereas we need to show people that there are real things that we can do and overcome various ethical issues first.
Farcical?
Farcical.
What does that even mean?
A farce is something that's... Blah, blah, blah. Kill
She's
it.
Using words she doesn't even know.
No, I do know what farcical means. It's a farce. It's like some sort of amusing story or front or a joke.
Listen, as more technology advances, the more farcical it becomes, right? Like, look, we have so much technology when it comes to computers. Like, 30 years ago, computers were the size of, like, this entire room, probably bigger. No one could afford it. No one could use it. Mm-hmm. Now people use computers to play video games. They could be using that to, like, solve, like, problems in cancer research, but they don't. People develop video games all the time. The console is just a fancy computer. Mm-hmm. So as technology gets more advanced, there's going to be, like, things that we're going to be doing with it that's frivolous, right? As it becomes more accessible, like, it's the same thing with synthetic biology.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's not going to just be, right now it's just for research, but mm-hmm. soon it's going to be commercialized, it's going to be for everything.
Mm-hmm. And no, I definitely agree that those applications are inevitable, I said, because
But you don't like it.
I think that there's just better things that we could be investing our time in.
Like, when there's 7 billion people in the world, you know, let some people have some fun.
Yeah, okay.
While the other people, like, you know, do their thing.
There's a limit. That's all I'm going to say.
Okay.
Thank you both, Ali and Victoria, for your insightful input into the development and definition in the field of synthetic biology. Also, thanks, Este, for being our resident biology novice.
Oh, my pleasure. I had fun.
That concludes our first segment of our 5-episode-length podcast, Syntox. And don't forget to check us out on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at IGEM Toronto. We'll see you next time with our episode on the cross-section of ethics and synthetic biology.